Well, I know what my nightmare will be about tonight.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to People, Parasites, and Plagues, a podcast aimed at delivering information about the fascinating pathogens among us from the scientists who study them. I am Kim Klonowski.
And I am David Peterson, your host for today's episode. When it comes to mosquitoes, most people, including scientists, are itching for a fight. But today's guest sees value in studying versus killing mosquitoes to better understand their role in disease transmission cycles.
Our guest today is Dr. Dan Peach, assistant professor in the Department of Infectious Diseases and the Savannah River Ecology Laboratory at UGA. Dan is also a member of the Center for the Ecology of Infectious Diseases. Dr. Peach works on many projects related to mosquito ecology. Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dan, one thing we'd like to ask our guests is about the start of their scientific journey. We've gotten some really interesting answers in the past, and I think your path into science is interesting as well. So why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. So when I was in high school, I never had science on my radar. I had working, you know, in a machine shop or as a welder or something as my career goal. But as I finished high school and then shortly thereafter, I really fell in love with just being outside. And that sort of transitioned into an interest in environmental sciences, which is what I started my undergrad in. So the biological stream of undergraduate sciences is what I enrolled in my undergraduate career. But I was paying my way through school by working as a nighttime security guard, which was rather grueling. And so I decided to start exploring, you know, other ways to maybe do that. I didn't have the grades to be competitive for scholarships or anything. And so I enrolled in the co-op education plan with the idea of getting a summer job. And I was interviewed by Agriculture Canada, which is sort of the Canadian version of the USDA. And they had a graduate student who was working on a project on some farms. And the farmers were making her feel a bit uncomfortable. And so me, being a 6'3" hockey player who was working as a security guard, but was also enrolled in a science degree, they figured, well, we'll get not only a research assistant, but maybe some added security out of the mix. And that's what really kickstarted my career. This was working with entomology, with a pest of cranberries, and I never had entomology on my radar. But this put it there very, very squarely. And the project was collaborating with a lab at Simon Fraser University. And I made a really good impression with them when I was working on this project. We were trying to identify the sex pheromone of this pest to develop bait, basically. And there was another lab we were sort of in a race against to do it. And, you know, I worked a lot of 14 and 16-hour days, but we managed to get it identified before them. We beat them by about a week to publication. So as a result of that, they figured, well, you know, this guy, he's clearly got the work ethic and the gumption. Let's give him a shot at grad school. And we had funding to work with mosquitoes. So that's what I took for my grad school research project and what kickstarted my science career.
It's been mosquitoes ever since.
It has been, yeah. Yep. I'd say it sucked, but it really hasn't.
I have a feeling we're going to get a lot of those in today. So Dan, when most people think about mosquitoes, they think about them as something that kind of makes us miserable, especially here in Georgia with our hot and humid summers. But this term mosquitoes covers lots of different species, and some of them probably have different hosts that they like to maybe feed on. So how many mosquito species are there?
Around the world, there are, give or take, approximately 3,500.
Wow.
It's seems to be growing every year, and then every now and then, you know, there are some taxonomic revisions that knock a few off. But in general, it's growing, and we think that represents approximately half of the species that are probably out there, just based on rates of new species discoveries. But each one has a unique ecology. They all do slightly different things. Different species vector different pathogens, feed on different things. Some species don't take blood from anything. It's probably a good time to point out that the fundamental food of an adult mosquito, for both a female and a male mosquito, is plant sugar, primarily in the form of floral nectar. It's only the females of some species that take blood, and they do that to develop their eggs.
So there seems to be good mosquitoes and bad mosquitoes. at least from our point of view.
Or at least, yeah, bad mosquitoes and irrelevant mosquitoes or benign mosquitoes, yeah.
So you also did work cataloging all the mosquito species in British Columbia and the Yukon Territories. So were you out there actually gathering them?
Yes, yeah. I was like a big pale Sasquatch walking through the woods out there. I was very fortunate. So I did my graduate degree looking at the sensory ecology of mosquitoes. We were trying to develop new baits or repellents, these sorts of things. But I was very lucky in that one of the last great extant mosquito taxonomists was an emeritus professor at the university that I was at, and I was put in contact with him. He was a World War II veteran from the UK. He taught me a lot about mosquito natural history and morphological identification, systematics, these sorts of things. And he really just inspired me to go out and look at what's out there in our natural world. British Columbia and the Yukon haven't had much attention paid as to what species are present and where they are. British Columbia had a bit when West Nile first arrived, but that there was some sampling and surveying that happened, but that fell off pretty quickly. The Yukon, I mean, there was a publication that was put out in the 90s that there are the six people that have ever come through here looking at mosquitoes that we know about. And so I was probably the seventh or eighth person that's ever been through the Yukon looking at what mosquitoes are present, at least in any, you know, broad scale fashion. And so from these activities, just sometimes it was just, my wife and I would go on a camping trip. Sometimes it was more targeted and systematic than that. But I found about half a dozen new species records for the Yukon, things that we didn't know were there. Found another first record for British Columbia, and found a few disease vectors that were present much farther north than anybody had thought that they were, although some of them we expect may have been present all along. When places haven't really had their biodiversity explored, you can't really say something has moved into a new area. So sort of trying to get a bit of a handle on that sort of thing. And funnily enough, one of these first records was part of the Yukon BioBlitz. So every year, the government of the Yukon has put on a BioBlitz where they bring in biologists from all around the Western Canada, essentially, to try and catalog what types of life are present in the Yukon. And I mean, they find species new to science. They found a bumblebee about the size of your thumb a couple of years ago, new to science. But as part of one of these, we met the organizer to pick up some equipment the night before the BioBlitz had started. And he'd just finished having, a couple of beers with a friend of his. And so he comes outside to give us this equipment, and I see a mosquito land on him. Stop, that's not supposed to be here. I need to collect that. So I got this. It was a first species record for the Yukon. And well, when you're drinking, you're more attractive to mosquitoes. So I like to tell him that, well, I'm glad that you were having a few beers there, or we might not know that this species was present.
Practical advice for our listeners then, the more beer you drink in the summer, the more the mosquitoes are going to like you.
Right. So was the idea, was the reason why people weren't serving mosquitoes because the assumption was that it was too cold and that mosquitoes wouldn't be there, so why bother looking?
Yeah, and I mean, in some cases it wasn't surveyed because Western Canada is a big place and there are finite resources. So it's there's a lot of places. Some of them are very remote. Some of them you can't get to by driving. There are remote First Nations villages that you have to fly in or take a boat in, and we don't really know what's there. But in other cases, our climate is changing and things might be north, and we just haven't really had a good handle on them because historically it was generally assumed, at least in that part of the world, that things were just too cold, right? You wouldn't have invasive species established, or if they did, it would be too cold for many of the pathogens they could spread. Whether that was the right or wrong approach is sort of irrelevant now because we're rapidly approaching, if not have already crossed, a threshold where that will no longer be the case. So, I mean, for other insects, we see invasive species show up in Canada and move south into the United States. Things like there was the murder hornet that showed up in the port of Vancouver, right, Moved into Washington State. So the sort of mindset that invasive species will only be moving from the south northward is not necessarily the case anymore. So there are concerns about, maybe an invasive mosquito showing up on a plane or a boat from Asia in the port of Vancouver and spreading from there. Or, the same thing happening on the East Coast with a species from Europe or Africa.
So you've already mentioned that plant nectar is really the number one source of nutrition for either male or female mosquitoes. And one line of research that you've pursued is to find out what attracts mosquitoes to feed and what exactly attracts them to flowers versus human host?
That's a great question. Probably many of the same things, it turns out. The sort of knowledge base that was out there when I started my graduate studies was that it was olfactory cues that attracted mosquitoes to flowers. And we were actually looking at trying to develop a floral bait, because then we could catch not just females, but also male mosquitoes, and you just have a better idea of what species were present. But we quickly found out that just using these floral odors, these chemicals that flowers emit that you and I smell, mosquitoes smell those too, right? So that's how they find flowers. But we quickly found out that using just those wasn't really doing the trick in the field. And so we kind of took a step back, thought, well, what other cues are known to attract mosquitoes to people? So when a mosquito finds us, they're relying on carbon dioxide in our breath. These volatiles from our own bodies or microbes that live on our skin, as well as visual cues, thermal cues, all sorts of different things. And so we thought, well, flowers and floral nectar are probably very important to mosquitoes. Why would they not use these same cues or these same sensory modalities to find them? We also started thinking that, you know, there was a sort of soundbite out there that mosquitoes aren't pollinators. And we thought, well, maybe that's not the case, because we keep finding them on flowers with lots of pollen on them. So we just sort of switched our conceptualization of mosquitoes. Like, well, maybe they're pollinators just like other flies. They have all these other sensory modalities that are available to them. It turns out that other flies use some of these modalities to find flowers as well. So things like ultraviolet cues on flowers, or at around dusk, flowers cease photosynthesis and become net producers of carbon dioxide. So we started thinking, maybe let's start tying these in a bit more. It got to be a bit much as far as just, you know, how much you want to bite off for grad school, but we found preliminary evidence at least for all of these. We found that mosquitoes are very sensitive in the ultraviolet spectrum, probably more sensitive than they are in the human visual spectrum. And flowers have UV cues on them. Many flowers do. It had been a bit of a mystery previously because the flowers that mosquitoes tended to visit were light in color, white, yellow. And, you know, when people are out hiking in the woods, right, we say, wear light-colored clothing so that you're not very attractive to mosquitoes. Well, sort of the whole point of a flower is to be this big visually conspicuous object, right? So if these visual cues are the main thing that they're going for, why would they have the least attractive cues for a potential pollinator? And then we started thinking about this UV thing. And so that sort of connected the dots there for us. And yeah, we found that when we eliminated sort of the UV portion of the spectrum, mosquitoes would no longer differentiate between flowers that they could see and smell, flowers they could just smell. But when we had that present, they would prefer the flowers that they could see and smell as opposed to the flowers that they could just smell.
So they are really just sensor packages or wings.
Absolutely. I mean, you look at their antennae, that's all sensory equipment on there. Most of their mouth parts are sensory. They have sensory appendages on the feet, a little bit on the wings. Almost every part of their body has some influence on how they perceive the world around them. And it makes sense. They're quite small, and they often have to go quite far to find nectar or blood meal or somewhere to lay their eggs or a mate. So they really need to be sensitive, right? They can't just send an email or a text message. They have to rely on this old, you know, analog equipment, and it has to be very sensitive for them to get it done.
So speaking of this old analog equipment, you hinted to the fact that they can use smell to be attracted to different things. Are there any other maybe non-traditional cues that may be relevant to attracting mosquitoes?
Well, non-traditional sources of cues, for sure. So there's a very interesting line of research that I'm hoping to pursue involving mosquito attraction to cheese. There were some Dutch researchers back in the 90s that did some work with Anopheles mosquitoes. And Anopheles mosquitoes are thought to preferentially bite around the feet and the ankles. One thing that might be going on there is the attraction to foot microbes, right? The same microbes that are responsible for smelly, stinky foot odor. And these microbes often do quite well in sweaty conditions. And these researchers also had a predilection for Limburger cheese, which smells not dissimilarly to stinky foot odor. And they found that these mosquitoes would also be attracted to this cheese when they tested it. And they actually won an Ig Nobel Prize for this. Which is an award for science that makes you laugh and then makes you think. But unfortunately, that research seems to have sort of dropped off, and I was very curious in this, so we sort of started it up again. We tested a number of different cheeses with a couple of different types of mosquitoes, mosquitoes in the genus Culex and in the genus Aedes, and we found that, yeah, most of the cheeses we tested were attractive to adults of these species. We found that Brie was the most attractive of the type that we we tried. So
interesting.
These mosquitoes had good taste. and we even found that it worked when you deployed it in the field. So if you were to take a mosquito trap and put some carbon dioxide, dry ice or whatever in there, and chop up a bit of brie, like we were using 50 grams, chop it up. So it was about $1 or $2 worth of brie. Put it in there. It would be much more attractive than if you just had CO2 alone.
So did you ever test this with the mosquitoes that don't take blood meal?
This was tested around the campus of Simon Fraser University, where I was enrolled in grad school, and we only had blood-feeding mosquitoes there. So I'm hoping to test it in a few other places as well. And I should note that we also took this a step or two further, where we ended up using homemade cheese. So just cheese starter powder, like microbial starter culture, and skim milk powder, mixed them together, threw them in water. Some types of microbial starter cultures would work with that. So we're hoping that we can develop that into something that can be deployed, in remote areas where one might not have access to carbon dioxide.
Okay, so to summarize quickly here, when we don't want to attract mosquitoes, and if we're going out in a picnic, we don't want to wear light-colored clothes.
We want to wear light-colored clothes.
We don't want to have brie or really any other cheese, and not beer.
No alcohol.
No alcohol in general.
Yeah, wine won't help you.
So these mosquitoes are really spoiling all the fun.
Yes.
Yeah, they sure can. They can be real, real big jerks.
So another line of research you've done, actually with one of our previous guests, Chris Cleveland, was on the connection between pigs, mosquitoes, and Japanese encephalitis virus.
Yeah, so this is some work that we're just starting off. Some of the background here is that Japanese encephalitis virus is not present in North America yet, but it's present in Asia, and it's spreading. It's recently spread to Australia, and it can be quite bad for especially young kids. It can cause encephalitis and all sorts of other issues. And pigs are its primary animal reservoir. They're the amplification hosts. It can also use wading birds like herons, ardeid birds. But pigs are the main worry. There's a fairly large swine industry in the United States, and there are lots of feral pigs out there. Well, what these feral pigs will do is they'll go and they'll create a wallow. So they'll make a nice depression in the ground. Usually it's somewhere, where it's moist, and these will fill with water. They'll be quite dirty and nutrient rich. And so this is concerning because in other parts of the world where this has been, studied a bit more in depth, for instance, in Hawaii, they found that there are invasive mosquitoes in the genus Culex that breed in these wallows. And these are also the primary vectors of Japanese encephalitis virus are mosquitoes that are in this genus. So one thing that we are concerned about the potential of is that for a mosquito that can use these wallows, it's sort of just a bed and breakfast, right? They have the breeding habitat there, and they have the blood host there. And there's the pigs make the habitat for the mosquitoes to breed in, and the mosquitoes feed on the pigs, and it's sort of this self-reinforcing cycle. And so in areas where Japanese encephalitis virus is endemic, they vaccinate at pigs that are in agricultural settings, right? So in hog farms and hog production facilities. You can't really do that with wild pigs. And so we're concerned that were this ever to show up, this pathogen, even if all of the agricultural facilities vaccinated their herds, there might be a reservoir out in the wild for this thing to hang on, and that might cause some issues.
So we've been talking about mosquitoes as being pests, right? As disease-carrying organisms, but do they have any other positive effects on the ecosystem you'd like to tell us about?
Sure. And I will put the caveat in place that mosquitoes are the world's deadliest animal.
Yes.
They've killed approximately half of all humans that have ever lived. So while I will talk about some of their positive ecological benefits, they have to be considered in that sort of context. But when mosquitoes are, nectar feeding and visiting flowers, they do seem to be able to pollinate, at least in some circumstances. And an active area of research for me is to try and figure out what they are pollinating and when, and is it, ecologically important? When is it? When isn't it? But also how to exploit these interactions to disrupt pathogen transition cycles. But not all mosquitoes transmit pathogens. Not all mosquitoes take blood, and not all mosquitoes take human blood. So if we are able to sort of surgically target the species that we are concerned about, for whether it's nuisance or pathogen transmission, whatever, if we're able to surgically target the species of interest and leave the other ones intact to maintain these ecological services, it might be a smart idea, because it's not, you know, it's not like pollinators are doing great out there these days. There are also other things going on, nutrient transfer. So mosquitoes in the larval stage are, for most species, they're filter feeders, essentially consuming algae, decomposing organic matter, essentially playing a role in the process of transforming energy from the sun into biologically available material, and then they develop to adulthood and fly off and are eaten or die. So there's some amount of nutrient transfer going on there too. And it might not be a lot when, you know, mosquito populations are low, but when you think of areas that have very high abundances of mosquitoes, it might play a fairly significant role.
So our previous guest, and I'm name-dropping Chris Cleveland again, I think he mentioned when we talked to him that during elk migration up north, the elk will actually actively avoid areas that have a lot of mosquitoes.
Caribou migration, but yeah. And they're doing it not just for mosquitoes. Things like black flies and biting midges play a role in that too. But, you know, these animals are migrating sometimes hundreds of kilometers, and they're going well out of their way to avoid areas. So it's, you know, materially significant. There was a fellow a while back who, up in the Arctic, so about where the tundra ends and the tree line starts, right at that border, it's thought that during peak mosquito season, that is the highest abundance of mosquitoes you can encounter anywhere on Earth. And so this fellow went up there and he measured the biting pressure on his arm, and he calculated that if he were to stand there naked and completely still for 2 hours, he would die of blood loss. And you'd have to have had one heck of a party the night before for that to ever be something that you'd be worried about, but it's sort of a shocking thing to think about.
Well, I know what my nightmare will be about tonight.
Not stinky cheese.
So I realize this isn't exactly your line of research, but you actually talked about it with the surgical removal of certain species, which we actually technically have the ability to do with CRISPR editing and this thing called gene drive. And I don't think we want to get into the details on gene drive, but should we do this?
It's certainly worth considering. When you put it in the context of, you know, how much human misery and suffering and mortality that mosquitoes do cause in some areas, I think that you do need to consider almost every option, right? If I'm living in a malaria endemic area and, you know, my children are all at serious risk of dying from malaria, I would want to have every option on the table there. So that's not to say to just go willy-nilly and go in firing from the hip, but certainly consider them and do your due diligence to make sure that they're safe and that they will actually work. Make them go through the appropriate research pipeline, but certainly consider doing that.
Okay.
So to close out this podcast, someone told us that you won the 3-minute thesis competition at your university.
I was actually a Canadian finalist.
Oh, a Canadian finalist.
Yeah, wow. I won the university. I placed for, I think it was third in Western Canada. And then I was a national finalist. I think I was fifth in Canada, but I'd have to double check that.
Wow, this is amazing. Well, can you tell our audience real quick, because just in case there's any subtle differences between how you do it in Canada versus the U.S., I imagine it's similar, but if you could just tell them real quick about what the 3-minute thesis competition is.
Sure. So the 3-minute thesis competition is essentially you have to communicate your thesis in 3 minutes or less. Even a second over, you are disqualified. You have one static slide to do so. And you present that to a room of people, and there are a panel of judges that score you on how well you did. There's also a people's choice sort of popular vote as well. You can advance through both mechanisms. I forgot to mention I actually won the people's choice at the scientific department level at Simon Fraser as well. And it's a great science communication process, because you have to translate your research into something that everybody can understand, but without dumbing it down to the point that it's not interesting and that specialists will, you know, wave you off.
Because the judges are not scientists.
Not necessarily. Some of them are maybe science adjacent. They're all very intelligent and qualified people. But you need to maintain the integrity of your message while also making it appeal to a broad array of people and in an interesting and entertaining but also educational fashion in a short period of time. And this is, I mean, it's wonderful. If you ever you don't need to go do an elevator pitch to somebody. You've done essentially that through a program like this, and you get to see, you know, how everybody else does it. It was a great, great experience.
And I should point out that we have the 3-minute thesis competition here at UGA. So a shout out to the graduate school for sponsoring that every year.
Yeah, it's a great exercise for students for exactly what Dan mentioned, was being able to communicate your research in a very concise way. So speaking of that, instead of taking 3 minutes, what we're going to maybe ask you to do now is in 3 sentences. I'm thinking back to the days where I would be outside collecting bugs and putting them in these little containers. And of course, my mom would say, you have to let them out at some point, you know, and our parents might think that that's a weird thing, you know, let alone to collect bugs as part of your career. So can you maybe tell us in 3 sentences why you think collecting and studying bugs is worthwhile?
Collecting insects keeps us connected and engaged with our natural world, and I'm a huge proponent of natural history. It's a very easy and engaging way to begin becoming exposed to that, and it can also create some very valuable data through citizen science programs that real researchers can use.
That was perfect.
That was. I see why you did so well in the 3-minute thesis.
Exactly. Thanks.
Our guest today is Dr. Dan Peach from the Department of Infectious Diseases and the Savannah River Ecology Lab. Dan, thanks for being with us.
It's been my pleasure. It's been just peachy.
Links to additional information about Dr. Peach's research can be found on our Instagram account at PPPPodcastUGA.
Thank you for tuning in today. Please rate the podcast, and if you have any questions or suggestions for future episodes, reach out to us via email at ppp@uga.edu. This podcast is brought to you by the Faculty of Infectious Diseases and the Grady College of Journalism at the University of Georgia. It is supported by the University of Georgia through the Office of Research, the UGA Graduate School, and the College of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks to the New Media Institute at Grady for use of their Studio Not Found podcast facilities, and a special thanks to our production assistant, Sid Wegand, for research, editing, scheduling, and generally keeping us on track.